Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. Is it true that Jewish people in the United States tend to support the Israeli government even when that government supports wars? My guest says no.
When Jewish people in the United States were asked what their core piece of their identity as a Jewish person was, 46% of them said social equality. Only 20% of them said Israel. And yet these big institutional Jewish organizations purport to speak for the Jewish community, and the way that they speak for the Jewish community is by saying we need to support the Israeli government no matter what it does.
In fact, Jewish Americans and the Israeli government seem to be moving in opposite directions.
The Israeli government has become more and more right-wing over the years, and so generally speaking, Jewish Americans are still pretty liberal, but Israel and Israelis are becoming less and less so. So young Jewish Americans identify less and less with Israel.
A large financial company in the United States, TIAA Cref, invests in companies that are profiting from the illegal occupation of Palestinian lands. A campaign is urging divestment from those companies.
What we're saying to TIAA Cref is that for people who do not want to profit and live on their retirement money off of companies like Caterpillar, that they need to divest from these companies.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio. I'm thrilled to have as a guest this week Rebecca Vilkomerson, who is the executive director of Jewish Voices for Peace. Their website is jvp.org. Rebecca, thanks for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm very glad to. Can you tell us what is Jewish Voices for Peace? How long has it been around? Who are its members and what's it about?
Sure. Well, the first thing I have to correct you slightly, our actual name is Jewish Voice for Peace, just so you know, but it is jvp.org, as you announced previously. So we are a nationwide diverse democratic organization inspired by Jewish tradition to work for a just resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict based on the core principles of equality, human rights, and international law. We really stand for security and self-determination and human rights for all people in the region. We have a mailing list now of about 100,000 supporters. We have 35 chapters around the country. We have a rabbinical council of rabbis who support our work. We have an advisory board of luminaries like Naomi Klein and Tony Kushner. And, you know, we're really a membership driven organization, lots of amazing local and national campaigns.
Yeah, and so what is the general advantage or idea behind having a particularly Jewish group for peace as opposed to simply a people for peace? Is there a religious or ethnic or what is the Jewish component exactly, and what does that bring to the conversation?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I mean, I think all Americans, of course, should be interested in this issue, primarily because Israel is the biggest recipient of military aid of any country of the world. So all of our tax dollars are certainly implicated in U.S. policy towards Israel. So it really should be something that's, you know, of concern, I think, to all Americans. I think for many of us as Jewish Americans, because Israel purports to speak in our name, because they speak rather than as a state of its citizens, they speak as the state of all the Jews around the world, that people feel, many people feel a strong need to stand up and say, this is, you know, not in my name. I don't accept this. And I think I think our membership has a range of people in it. Some people feel very, very strongly that they're doing this from a place of their understanding of Jewish values and that this is an expression of their Judaism. Other people see it as a strategic advantage that, you know, AIPAC is a very, very strong, part of a very, very strong lobby, which also, of course, includes Christian evangelicals and that sort of thing. But that lobby has been very, very skillful in exploiting the idea of anti-Semitism as a way to sort of muscle dissent on current American policies. And so by being sort of loud and proud and Jewish in our approach to this work, we're able to have a certain impact on the conversation that we might not otherwise.
How much money, so everyone knows who probably have recently paid their taxes, goes to the government of Israel in the form of weapons each year?
$3 billion a year.
$3 billion from
Correct.
U.S. taxpayers.
$3 billion from U.S. taxpayers every year. Largest recipient of military aid of any country in the world.
And I wonder, because there's not really a Everybody for Peace group out there, and I've joined Code Pink even though I'm not a woman, and I've joined Veterans for Peace even though I'm not a veteran. You know, there's not a middle-aged white guys who never went to war for peace group, right? Can I join Jewish Voice for Peace even though I'm...
You absolutely can. I mean, you know, we identify ourselves as a Jewish organization. We welcome members who are not Jewish. You know, we're sort of trying to be very careful while we keep this particular Jewish identity, which many of us feel very strongly about, that everyone feels welcome and able to participate. We certainly don't want to recreate what Israel does, which is essentially privilege Jewishness over non-Jewishness in for its own citizens and residents. So, you know, we certainly aren't in favor of that. So everyone is welcome to be a member. The other thing I would recommend to people is to look into the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. JVP is a member of that coalition, and it's a coalition of organizations working on this issue. And, you know, for folks who aren't interested in having a sort of a religious connection to their work on this issue, they're a great organization to be a part of.
Terrific. We are speaking with Rebecca Vilkomerson, who is the executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace, jvp.org. I'm curious how you're seeking to change the public understanding in the United States to insert a different voice into the conversation and what that single voice is. I recently had a conversation about whether or not President Obama was an enemy of Israel or a friend of Israel, and I dared to suggest that his militarism and his support for arming Israel might be friendship with Israel's government, but perhaps not being a friend of Israel. How are you seeking to insert your voice in conversations, for example, around the militaristic talk toward Iran?
Well, there's a lot to unpack in that question. Let me try to take it all the different aspects one at a time. I think, first of all, you know, our overarching analysis of where things are politically in this country on this issue is that there hasn't really, in the last few decades, been a significant difference between Republicans and Democrats on this issue. It is virtually impossible, given the politics today, for any president or the Congress to in any way cut this, you know, massive aid package that Israel receives. And if you remember, Bibi Netanyahu, not in this most recent visit that he had not long ago, but in his previous one, you know, he went before Congress and got something like 29 standing ovations. So there's a very, very strong, you know, preconception of politicians that they are going to get campaign contributions if they vote a certain way. And so I think that that's, you know, that's very, very hard right now to make inroads on. So the approach that we take beyond that is, in addition, you know, our analysis is that the peace process, which began about 20 years ago, and I use peace process in quotes because really the United States has acted in Israel's interest. It claims to be an honest broker, but has really acted in Israel's interest throughout that process. And what it's resulted in is more and more settlements and the entrenching the occupation even more than it had been. So I think there's a growing awareness that relying on governments, including our own government, to solve this problem and bring peace to the region is a non-starter, and so therefore we have to take it to civil society, take it to the streets, essentially. And so we really model ourselves on grassroots movements that have been successful. So I think I would use examples like the civil rights movement and the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa as examples, successful examples of ways that people power have overcome political power. And so the overarching thing that we're trying to do is to educate people and move them into action on this issue. And there are a lot of misperceptions about what is actually happening in Israel and Palestine that we have to overcome. There's a lot of, you know, as I said, sort of ways that the media misportrays what's actually going on that needs to be overcome. And then there's a question of how to make a difference if we cannot, you know, take the traditional alleyways of lobbying. So the strategy that we've taken up is Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS. The BDS movement overall was initiated by Palestinian civil society in 2005. And it's a rights-based movement. It doesn't have a particular political solution in mind. It simply wants an end to the occupation and the separation wall. It wants equality for Palestinians inside of Israel, and it wants rights for refugees of the Palestinian diaspora all over the world. So JVP, in particular, we practice BDS campaigns that focus on the occupied territory specifically. That's the way that we contribute to the movement. And so our biggest national campaign is trying to get TIA CREF, which is, I think, the country's largest pension fund. They serve primarily universities, but also nonprofits and medical systems, organizations like that, but their retirement funds, and they're currently invested in a bunch of companies that are profiting from the occupation. So our nationwide campaign, which now has a lot of partners, is to get TIA-CREF to divest from those companies. And it's really modeled on the kind of divestment campaigns that were eventually successful in the anti-apartheid era. And the idea, of course, is through the story of these of the companies that we're targeting, you know, such as Caterpillar is a perfect example. Caterpillar sells enormous, deadly, militarized bulldozers to the Israeli army that are routinely used to destroy Palestinian homes and orchards and their livelihoods. And on at least one occasion, very famous case, a military bulldozer driven by a member of the Israeli army, crushed and killed an American activist named Rachel Corey when she was standing in front of a Palestinian home trying to protect it from destruction. So Caterpillar has a long record of human rights abuses and that its products are being used in contravention to international law, and yet Caterpillar is still being held TIA-CREF. So what we're saying to TIA-CREF is that for people who do not want to profit live on their retirement money off of companies like Caterpillar, that they need to divest from these companies, especially because Caterpillar is still even in TIA-CREF's Social Choice Fund, and the Social Choice Fund was actually created during the anti-apartheid years as an option for people who wanted to have a human rights-based retirement. So that's one of the ways that we talk about it and the way that we frame it. But I think what's interesting is that by talking about Caterpillar and all the other countries, we're also able to tell the story of the occupation. So we're able to educate people about what is actually going on. You know, what does it mean, destroying Palestinian homes, destroying Palestinian orchards? What is the separation wall? What are the drones that are attacking Gaza? What is the, in the case of Motorola, what is the telecommunications equipment that's being used to keep Palestinian and Israeli populations separate in the West Bank? So through talking about these companies and through this campaign, we're able to really educate folks about what's going on, and then for those who are interested, able to bring them into action, because people can do local campaigns on TIA-CREF that then are linked to the national campaign. So, for example, earlier today I spoke at Connecticut College. I'm speaking tomorrow at UConn. Both of those campuses use TIA-CREF for their retirement funds. So there's a lot of opportunities to do exciting local campaign work and to feel linked to these national campaigns, which I think people really appreciate. And we can do these instead of doing, you know, events here and there. We can sort of escalate and build these campaigns that can be very, very effective in various different ways and can be very creative. So that's one way we do the work. The other way we do the work, you know, and that work in particular is not, the BDS work is not specific necessarily to the Jewish community. The other piece of our work really does focus on the Jewish community and trying to change the paradigm of the conversation, as you mentioned earlier, trying to change the perception that, which, you know, has been very, very common for many years, that a few mainstream, large institutional Jewish organizations really speak for the entire Jewish community, which really turns out not to be true. A poll just came out that showed that when Jewish people in the United States were asked what their core piece of their identity as a Jewish person was, 46% of them said social equality. Only 20% of them said Israel. And yet there's this, you know, so more than twice as many care about social equality than about Israel as a central part of their identity, and yet these big institutional Jewish organizations purport to speak for the Jewish community, and the way that they speak for the Jewish community is by saying we need to support the Israeli government no matter what it does. And that sort of goes back, I think, to your question, which is, you know, I think the Republican Party has the true ideological they see the most eye-to-eye with the Israeli government. The Israeli government has become more and more right-wing over the years, and so the Republican Party and the Israeli government really have the same principles and are allied in a true fashion. I think the Democrats, perhaps to a somewhat lesser extent, actually believe in the kinds of laws, especially recently, that the Israeli government has been passing that are quite anti-democratic. So I think it's interesting if there is eventually going to be some light between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party position. But in the meantime, we see our job as widening the perception of the idea that these large Jewish institutions that are speaking in all of our names don't actually represent us. And I think, you know, we have 100,000 people who are supporters of ours who have taken an action in support of our work, and that's not certainly not the majority, but it's not insignificant either. And so, you know, we're trying to help people to understand just how diverse the opinion actually is in the Jewish community on this issue.
Rebecca Vilcomerson is the Executive Director of Jewish Voice for Peace, jvp.org, if you want to find out about bringing such actions to your campus or otherwise get involved. You mentioned, Rebecca, when Benjamin Netanyahu came and spoke in Congress and got more cheers than anyone else. I think he also spoke elsewhere in this country, and your organization was involved in interrupting or protesting him. Am I right about that?
You are right. You're conflating two visits, but he came to the U.S. in November of 2010 to speak at the Jewish Federation General Assembly, which is the sort of the biggest gathering of Jewish organizations in the United States. And we did indeed, that was where we launched our youth wing, which has since grown exponentially. And what really, you know, one of the reasons why we chose to protest him then was we thought it was very, very important to protest sort of from inside the Jewish community and to say, you know, you're here, you're speaking to the Jewish federations as if, you know, as if you represent us, but you don't. And so what we did is we had five exceptionally brave young people who one at a time stood up in this meeting and said, you know, settlements are not a reflection of Jewish values. The loyalty oath is delegitimizes Israel. At that time, there was, and still now, there's a lot of rhetoric around the attempted, in quotes, delegitimization of Israel. And people say, oh, by criticizing Israel, you're trying to delegitimize it. And so we were trying to say, you know, it's Israel's actions that's delegitimizing it, not the rhetoric around it. So one by one, we had these young activists stand up and with these signs and yell into the crowd. And it was, you know, watching the video, it still sort of gives me shivers because the first one was able to speak for quite a long time, and by the second or third, the crowd was in a frenzy and just attacking them immediately, and they were engulfed by these people, and one of them had a pillow stuffed in her mouth, and at some point a rabbi, you know, picked up one of our signs and ripped it with his teeth. So it was like this very sort of frenzied reaction to, you know, what was in the end five people expressing their opinions in a way that was actually, in terms of message, it was not terribly radical. It was just in the method and the fact that it was at this Bibi Netanyahu speech that they took this action. So it got tons and tons and tons of media attention and really touched off a discussion that I think is still happening within the Jewish community, which is about you know, a strong desire within the Jewish community, I think, to hold on to its youth, but at the same time, an unwillingness to hear what its concerns are. And there's a famous article by a guy named Peter Beinart that came out in the spring of 2010, which I think outlines very, very nicely what's happening, which is that, generally speaking, Jewish Americans are still pretty liberal, but Israel and Israelis are becoming less and less so. So young Jewish Americans identify less and less with Israel, and they're sort of going in opposite directions. And there's an emphasis within the Jewish community on Israel as sort of the primary value, as opposed to maybe Judaism or to community service or to, I don't know, ethical reflection, that sort of thing. So the organized Jewish community is very, very concerned about what happened to youth, and we were able to capitalize on that and make, you know, and therefore make it into, you know, really start a real discussion and a lot of soul searching. And it was very, very controversial, and we got a lot of attacks for it, and we still do. But it's something that we're very, very proud of.
Yes, as you should be. Another young woman named Ray Abele spoke in the congressional appearance of Netanyahu and was tackled by a guy in the balcony.
Right, and she was one of the young women who was with us in New Orleans, actually, as well.
Yes, and a great activist. Explain to people this strategy that you began to talk about of boycott, divestment, and sanctions, because there are those, myself included, in the peace movement, who typically are quite wary of the idea of sanctions, in that we have killed a great many people through sanctions in Iraq. We're now imposing sanctions on Iran that are making life difficult for people. How is it a peaceful tool of nonviolent pressure in the case of the Israeli occupation?
I think that's a really, really excellent point, and I'm really glad you brought it up. I mean, there's a few things. First of all, we're, at least in terms of the United States, we're so far from sanctions that it's almost something that we don't think about. We're still struggling mightily to get even having the smallest boycott and divestment campaigns be successful on a broad level. We've had some small victories, but are still working towards the larger ones. And you know, these were tactics that were used again. You know, I think BDS tactics have been used, especially the B and the D, have been used in social justice movements for a long time now. You know, you can think about the civil rights movement and the bus boycotts. You can think about Cesar Chavez and the grape and lettuce boycotts. You can think about now, you know, there's wonderful economic campaigns around Trader Joe's and how much tomato pickers are paid. There's people who make economic choices around, you know, who to patronize if they support gay rights or not. So I think, you know, this tool that we have as citizens and residents of this country as a way for civil society, for people who are frustrated and upset with what their governments are doing but want to have a way to show what their values are, people vote with their pocketbook. And so I think it's an incredibly potent weapon, and it's a weapon that the Palestinian people have asked us to use. And I think that's important, too, because given that they are the ones who are suffering under occupation, it behooves us to as much as we can, from, you know, as much as, of course, as long as we agree with it, we shouldn't do anything that feels wrong to us. But to the extent that it's something that feels right, and as a tool that's, you know, nonviolent, certainly compared to the alternatives, I think it's a very, very powerful one. Now, your question about sanctions, I think, is a good one, and it's something we'll probably need to think more about if and when governments begin to sanction Israel. I do think there's something different between civil society directed sanctions that target bad government actors, as opposed to imperial powers like ours, which are targeting smaller countries. You know, I just think there's a qualitative difference. Even though they're both called sanctions, they're a different kind of animal. But you know, I think it is something that we all need to face. That the idea behind boycott, divestment, and sanctions is that there's a degree of consequences, that that the choice to support a right-wing government that is oppressing people based on their ethnic identity involves some degree of punishment. Now, whether that punishment is, you know, not seeing Madonna in concert, or whether it's that your tomatoes can't be sold in European markets anymore, or if it's that, you know, your companies can't sell things in the United States, I think that that's, a pretty small price to pay, given the complicity of Israeli people in the current policies. I think if and when we get to a place of sanctions, then we will have to have that discussion, and we'll all need to think about how we want them to be imposed. My guess is that there, we will never get to a place of sanctions that have a serious effect on the people of Israel. My guess is it's potential that business owners and business people will start to be scared. But the truth is that there's, you know, to a large extent, BDS is a symbolic action and an educational action, especially at this stage. And the other thing is, I think that it's important to remember that, again, the Palestinian people were the ones who are the first to suffer, actually, under BDS, have asked us to take these actions, and we take that very seriously. They're willing to sacrifice and have perhaps a harder time in the short run in order for a form of liberation in the longer run. So it's a complicated question and a good one, but I think that, you know, it's the tactics are appropriate ones given the circumstances.
Another example that comes to mind, of course, is apartheid South Africa, and the civil rights movement you mentioned, the Montgomery bus boycott. I noticed on your website, Jewish Voice for Peace, JVP.org, a statement of solidarity with the Palestinians' effort as freedom riders sitting on segregated buses in intentional parallel with the historical actions in the U.S. civil rights movement. Can you tell people what that is about and to what extent this really is a struggle against a Jim Crow apartheid system?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. And I think, you know, for us, one of the most exciting things we can do is support both Palestinian activists and also the very brave Israeli activists. I mean, the Palestinian activists are incredibly brave, but they have the support of their people. The Israeli activists who are active in this movement are going against their society. And so, you know, it's a different kind of bravery. I don't mean to compare it. But in any case, we love it when we have the opportunity to show solidarity and support for these kind of brave actions. And this Freedom Rides action is a particular case in point. We were approached by some young Palestinian activists who had been educated here in the United States, and were very, very aware of the history and the significance of the Freedom Rides. And I think, you know, what was very smart about what they did is, you know, the civil rights movement in its time was extremely controversial, just like Israel and Palestine is now. And, you know, when you learn about the civil rights movement now, there's only one correct path. Everyone thinks that it's crazy that black people could not ride anywhere they wanted in the buses and all the other things, you know, that the civil rights movement were about. But at the time, it was super controversial. And so, you know, it was very, very powerful during the civil rights movement, and it's powerful now when these Palestinians got on these buses that are run by Veolia, in some cases, which is one of our target companies on the TIHF campaign, I might add, that are running through Palestinian territory, and yet only Israelis can get on those buses, not Palestinians. So, you know, the idea was very simple, just like it was during the civil rights movement, which was, you know, why are we unequal here? Why do we not have the rights that Israelis have? And they got on the bus and they were arrested. We did 15 actions around the country in support of them in various cities. And again, it was an incredible opportunity for us to educate people about what is the reality on the ground for Palestinians living in the West Bank and Gaza. What kind of restrictions are they living under? The fact that they have to go through checkpoints, that they can't reach their workplaces and get to education and get health care, that their orchards are being destroyed, that that every part of their life is essentially governed by the occupation. I think that's very still not well known, and it's very, very important that we help to get that message out. So that was a very exciting action in that it helped, I think, in a sense that resonated for the American listener, viewer, or whatever way they heard about it, with our own struggles.
We have maybe a minute left. I know that the Park Slope Food Co-op in New York City recently took an action that presumably other organizations around this country might take. Can you briefly describe what that was?
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, one other co-op already has. The Olympia Food Co-op in Washington State has already successfully initiated a boycott of Israeli products, and that's what the Park Slope Co-op was trying to do. And they failed to do that, but again, in the process, it created an enormous conversation. There was press in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and New York Magazine and Gawker. And so again, I think in the stage we're in, you know, one of the things we learned from the South African movement is this struggle can take decades, and it's going faster now, partially because of, you know, the kind of media that we have and for other reasons, but the process of education is part of the process. And so they didn't win that vote, but they were able to do an enormous amount of education in the process.
We've been speaking with Rebecca Vilkomerson, who is the executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace. The website is jvp.org. Rebecca, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Next week's guest on Talk Nation Radio will be Stephen M. Cohn, executive director of the National Whistleblowers Center, author of 8 books on whistleblowers' law, including The Whistleblowers' Handbook. Cohn is representing Sibel Edmonds, whose amazing book, Classified Woman, is being published this week. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, engineered by Christiane Brown in Reno, Nevada, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.